From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! A look at how possible Republican vice presidential candidates have voted on choice and reproductive rights. A Republican Congress member is outed. We'll take a look at the politics and ethics of outing.
I mean, I'm glad to have another openly gay member of Congress because I think that's important. I don't support the means to get there necessarily. I don't support outing of people or pressuring people to make that decision.
And a former Clinton advisor talks about his disillusionment with the administration he helped elect.
Bill Clinton has done more for it than any other president in history for the gay and lesbian community. It's important for me to say that because it would be untruthful if I didn't. But the fact of the matter is, it would be like saying to African Americans in 1963, I've just given you a civil rights bill. I've done more for you than any other president in history, so don't ask me for the right to vote. You know?
All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only daily election show. I'm Amy Goodman. Seeking to re-energize his Republican presidential campaign, Bob Dole will propose a Reagan-esque across-the-board tax cut of 15% today, rejecting more modest measures favored by some advisors. Advisors put the price tag of the economic package at $548 billion over 6 years and suggest it would mean lower taxes for 90 million Americans. The White House and President Clinton's re-election campaign immediately assailed the reported proposal. Vice President Al Gore said it would blow a hole in the deficit. And White House economic advisor Gene Sperling suggested Dole's package could cost more than $800 billion. He called it a collection of gimmicks, double counting, and voodoo growth assumptions. Announcing the economic package begins a crucial week for Dole, who trails Clinton by as much as 20 percentage points in some national polls. In the week ahead, he must also settle on a running mate and prepare for the Republican National Convention, which begins next Monday in San Diego. Advocating such a large tax break, it resembles the one former President Reagan campaigned on in 1980, represents a stark turnabout for Dole. The former Senate Majority Leader has a history of preferring to cut the deficit to cutting taxes. Even so, he's expected to assert that even with the 15% tax cut, the federal budget can be balanced by the year 2002. Dole is also expected to propose halving the capital gains tax from 28% to 14%, repeal of the 1993 tax increase on certain Social Security benefits, and a $500 per child tax credit. And Barry Goldwater says it was only a joke. The Republican conservative patriarch says he was only kidding when he suggested he could vote for Democrat Bill Clinton over Republican rival Bob Dole. The former Arizona senator and Republican presidential nominee says he is Dole's campaign chair in Arizona and intends to vote for Dole in November. During a scholarship forum on Saturday, Goldwater said he thought that Clinton is doing a good job as president. Goldwater, who's 87, got laughs when he said he would vote for Dole if he were the only one running. And aides say Bob Dole is narrowing his list for a running mate as the convention in San Diego draws closer. Dole campaign sources say top prospects include Arizona Senator John McCain, Florida Senator Connie Mack, and former South Carolina Governor Carol Campbell. But they've also hinted at a surprise choice. And Congress was hesitant to give the FBI greater wiretapping powers because of the Bureau's mishandling of sensitive files given to the White House. This according to House Speaker Newt Gingrich. Democrats rejected that argument, blaming conservative Republicans for the failure of Congress to pass tough anti-terrorism legislation President Clinton requested following the TWA airliner explosion and the Olympics bombing. And CIA Director John Deutsch has ordered an internal review of any spy agency links to alleged U.S.-sanctioned criminal activity in Arkansas when President Clinton was governor. This according to a CIA spokesperson yesterday. David Christian, an agency spokesperson, said Deutsch had ordered a probe of a range of questions and allegations that have been raised concerning events in MENA, Arkansas, and into any possible connections with U.S. intelligence agencies. The airport in MENA, about 15 miles from the Oklahoma border, was the alleged center of a government-sanctioned cocaine trafficking and money laundering scheme that purportedly helped finance covert arms shipments to Nicaragua's Contra rebels in the early 1980s. And a survey of delegates shows the abortion debate could reach the Republican convention floor. An Associated Press survey of the Republican Platform Committee indicates there's a good chance the convention will erupt in a nasty floor fight over abortion. The survey finds that delegates who want to keep strong anti-abortion language in the Republican Party platform will have the upper hand when platform committee meetings start today. But it also shows that opponents of the plank have more than enough support to bring the issue to the floor in San Diego. And finally, more potential trouble for the Christian Coalition. The group acknowledges accepting $60,000 from a businessman who asked that it be used to support President Bush's reelection bid. Campaign finance experts say the transaction appears improper and could bolster the government's case accusing the tax-exempt coalition of violating federal election laws by aiding Republicans. The coalition denies the money was misused. It also denies falsifying records to disguise the contribution. That charge is being made by the group's chief financial officer, Judy Leibert. She was suspended from her job recently after going to federal authorities with concerns about coalition finances. She says she was told by coalition director Ralph Reed to record the donation as an anonymous gift. And you're listening to Democracy Now!
Bob Dole says he's a doer, not a talker. On abortion, now he's talking tolerance. But look at what he's done. In Congress, Bob Dole voted 107 times against a woman's right to choose. He even voted for a constitutional amendment to overturn Roe v. Wade. And the Dole party platform would make abortion illegal, no exceptions. Call NARAL at $2.75 a minute for the facts about Bob Dole, the 104th Congress, and their record on the right to choose. Because it shouldn't be their choice. It should be yours.
A commercial produced by the National Abortion and Reproductive Rights Action League. NARAL is holding a news conference today in Washington to unveil the ad and to talk about the stands on abortion taken by those on Bob Dole's shortlist of possible vice presidential candidates. Joining us to talk about their records is James Wagner, executive vice president of NARAL and a former chief of staff to Senator Howard Metzenbaum. Welcome to Democracy Now! Why don't we begin with the records of the candidates that are most being talked about now? We've just gotten word that Tom Ridge of Pennsylvania, as well as another vice presidential candidate, are, well, basically saying they don't want the job. I think it's Voinovich. But what about some of the candidates that are most being talked about right now, like Florida Senator Connie Mack?
Well, the senator from Florida, Connie Mack, has a comprehensive anti-choice record in the Senate. He has opposed the Freedom of Choice Act, which would basically codify Roe. He has supported measures to take away from federal employees their private insurance coverage for abortion. He has voted to remove Medicaid coverage for victims of rape and incest. So across the board, we have a comprehensively anti-choice record on the part of Senator Mack. And indeed, most of these candidates that have been put forward as VP nominees have nearly complete anti-choice records. And that's one aspect to consider. Another aspect, however, is whether it makes a difference who is vice president on this issue, with candidate Dole having made absolutely clear that he'll move the anti-choice agenda in Congress, irrespective of the smokescreen and tolerance that he's trying to put around the platform. We view the selection of VP as not really the issue here. It may sound a little startling, but in reality, and the way the system works, it doesn't matter whether it's Jesse Helms or Susan Molinari as the vice presidential pick. What matters is that Bob Dole has given his commitment to the Christian Coalition and other groups in this country to move the anti-choice agenda. In fact, when he was campaigning as during the primaries, I believe it was in Iowa, he gave a commitment that on his first day in office, Bob Dole as president would move executive orders to attack a woman's right to choose. He promised, among other things, to prohibit the availability of RU-46 in this country, a non-surgical medical method of abortion that an FDA advisory committee has recently recommended for availability in this country. It's been available in Europe for a number of years. So we're releasing today the records of these vice presidential nominees, putative nominees, while at the same time drawing attention to Bob Dole's record and the record of this Congress, which we think matters a whole heck of a lot more than the record of any vice presidential candidate.
You know, it's interesting, although Tom Ridge, the Republican governor of Pennsylvania, has said he doesn't want to be the running mate of Bob Dole, he has been characterized in the media as pro-choice. You don't have such a generous description of him.
No. In fact, by an analysis, I believe we have about 54 votes from Mr. Ridge when he was in Congress. And of those votes, nearly half were anti-choice votes. The exact votes, he had 54 votes on abortion in Congress, and 21 were anti-choice. He voted against allowing federal employees to choose abortion coverage in their private health insurance, even in cases of rape and incest. And he also opposes access to abortions for women who rely on the government for their health care. He's opposed that across the board. As governor, Mr. Ridge pursued an appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court to deny victims of rape and incest Medicaid coverage for abortions unless the woman first reported the crime to local law enforcement officials under a very rigorous and restrictive series of bureaucratic regulations. Even on family planning, an issue that you would assume a so-called moderate would be in the forefront and would really be taking a strong stand. But as governor in the fall of 1995, Mr. Ridge placed a gag rule in state contracts with family planning providers. What that means is that women who depend on the government for their health care, they don't have the right to learn about the legal option of abortion. They can go in and get information on contraception, but the clinic worker can't give the woman information about the legal right to an abortion. So I think Mr. Ridge's image and reputation as being a moderate and being pro-choice is out of step with his record not only as a congressperson, but also as governor of the state of Pennsylvania.
Now, someone whose name is being thrown around a bit more these days is Carol Campbell, the governor of South Carolina. We know that he is for flying the Confederate flag over the Capitol in South Carolina. What about his stand on abortion?
Right. I think his stand on abortion is no more progressive than that. He is anti-choice across the board, opposes Roe v. Wade, and believes that government and politicians should be making this decision, not women and their families. It's somewhat ironic, but again, Governor Campbell, I've read some press reports where people have sort of thrown a moderate cloak about him because of some controversy around the state convention in South Carolina, where there was a controversy around whether the governor would be named as a delegate to the Republican convention and whether his slate would move forward. This is just a battle on the far right. The Christian Coalition and other groups were flexing their muscles in a number of states and deciding that only delegates who were virulently, in their camp and connected to their particular organization should go. So there was some disturbance around Governor Campbell, which gave some people the impression, well, if the Christian Coalition and other hard right groups are out there opposing his slate and opposing his attendance at the Republican convention, then he must be moderate. But this is not the case. This is a fight on the far, far right, and Governor Campbell is well out of the mainstream when it comes to women's reproductive freedom in this country.
Now, Senator John McCain has long been a close friend of Bob Dole. What about his stand? He's one of the few on the very short list that we're hearing about now, although clearly anyone could be chosen.
Right. In Senator McCain's case, he has cast 79 votes on abortion and reproductive rights in his 13 years in Congress, and 75 of those votes were anti-choice votes. Not only does he oppose Roe v. Wade, not only has he voted to gut the family planning program and to deny federal support for victims of rape and incest, but McCain voted against the FACE bill. This was the Freedom of Access to Clinic Entrances Act, a piece of federal legislation that was passed after the horrific wave of violence where five people have been murdered at women's health clinics, both physicians and volunteers. And in the wake of this violence, Congress, quite appropriately, moved a piece of legislation to make it a federal crime to use violence against abortion providers or the threat of violence. And I'd make clear here, this didn't interfere with free speech rights. People can stand outside that clinic and make their views known in any way they choose, but they can't use violence and terror and intimidation to do it. And unfortunately, Senator McCain voted against that bill, which I think is a pretty good indicator of just how sort of far out on this issue and how extreme a position he has adopted. So there's very little good news in this mix that Mr. Dole is considering. And yet you listen to him over the last number of months and you'd believe he's the most tolerant and sympathetic individual when it comes to women's reproductive freedom. The reality is his congressional record has been totally anti-choice, and the measures that he would support as president, both in terms of securing anti-choice judges to the Supreme Court and moving executive orders and signing legislation that Congress has passed, would make Dole the most anti-choice president in U.S. history. So our message today at the press conference is ignore the smoke, ignore the mirrors, look at this man's record, and look at the tremendous threat that he poses to women's reproductive freedom in 1996.
We're talking to James Wagner, Executive Vice President of the National Abortion and Reproductive Rights Action League. You know, I mentioned earlier that Ohio Governor George Voinovich says he doesn't want to be considered as the number two man in the, if there was a Republican administration. But there are other Midwestern governors who are still on the list. There's Governor Jim Edgar and Governor John Engler, as well as Governor Tommy Thompson. Can you go through their records?
Sure. Governor Engler has long been a poster boy for the hard right anti-choice movement. They like him quite a bit, which should send chills up the spine of pro-choice Americans. Engler has a consistently anti-choice record as governor.
In Michigan.
During the 94 gubernatorial race, he refused to sign a pledge saying that he would not sign legislation to make abortion illegal, even in the case of rape or incest. So he wasn't even willing to stake out in a campaign environment protection for victims of rape and incest when it comes to access to abortion services. Governor Tommy Thompson of Wisconsin, he's been a longstanding opponent of abortion rights in this country. And indeed, as chief administrator of the state, has moved legislation that would impose obstacle after obstacle and burden after burden in the path of women trying to obtain abortions, including 24-hour waiting periods and other obstacles. So again, we have two governors here who have shown in their own states that they will take aggressive steps to restrict women's access to abortion and to oppose a woman's right to choose.
And Governor Jim Edgar?
Governor Edgar in Illinois is slightly different. He has a mixed record on abortion, but generally, again, has not been someone who supports Roe v. Wade, who's someone who may decide an issue one way or another on the edges, as it's often described. But when it comes to supporting reproductive freedom and being strong and in the forefront as an advocate, he certainly doesn't pass that mark. You'd have to give him sort of a confused, mixed record on choice.
And how would you rate Oklahoma Senator Don Nichols, another that is thought to be on the short list of Bob Dole for vice presidential running mates?
I think I worked in the Senate for 10 years, and you sort of draw a rule of thumb. There are people who vote a certain issue, and then there's people who get down on the floor and talk about it and get involved and really take an ideological stand for a particular issue. Unfortunately, Senator Nichols is in that latter category. Not only does he have a consistently anti-choice voting record, but in addition, whenever there's a measure on the Senate floor, you can be virtually assured that Senator Nichols will be there pushing the anti-choice cause. He's extremely strong anti-choice member. He works this issue in committee. He's one of the members on the Senate floor that will be developing amendment strategies to ensure that whatever anti-choice measure is being pushed. It can be tacked on as a rider to an appropriations bill or to a subcommittee report or any other vehicle that comes through that Senate. You can count on Senator Nichols being in the forefront of trying to move the anti-choice measure.
James Wagoner, we only have about 30 seconds, but I did want to ask you for your evaluation of the keynote speaker in the Republican convention, and that is Susan Molinari, the Congress member from New York. She's been described as pro-choice by the media. I know that she voted against, or rather for, the dilation and extraction ban that was just passed in the Senate, what many call the partial birth ban.
Right. Amy, she did vote for a measure that would, for the first time since Roe, criminalize an abortion procedure. In the past, she has been a strong pro-choice advocate, and we have supported her in the past. She has shifted her stance with recent votes, and I think has put partisan concerns in 96 above and before her pro-choice convictions here in this election year.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us, James Wagoner, Executive Vice President of NARAL and a former Chief of Staff to Senator Howard Metzenbaum of Ohio. NARAL is going to be holding a news conference on the voting records of the possible vice presidential running mates of Bob Dole, and also on their ad that they have just released on Bob Dole and his record on choice. You're listening to Democracy Now! Up next, we're going to take a look at the issue of outing. Stay with us. Listening to Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's daily grassroots election show. A political ad is being released today by a gay rights group using the marriages of three prominent Republicans, one of whom was previously divorced and two who wed people of other races, to criticize lawmakers for opposing same-sex unions. As an image of GOP presidential candidate Bob Dole and his wife Elizabeth appears, the announcer notes there was a time when a divorced man would not have made an ideal candidate for marriage. Elizabeth is Dole's second wife. The spot by the Human Rights Campaign also shows Texas Republican Senator Phil Graham with his wife Wendy, who is of Korean ancestry, and Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, who is black, with his wife Virginia, who is white. It says, there was a time when some marriages would not have been accepted or were so shocking to the majority that they were illegal. Some are still not, the announcer says, as a smiling lesbian couple appears on screen. Goes on to say, why are Bob Dole and Congress wasting our time with new laws attacking gay relationships? They have better things to do, the announcer says. David Smith, a spokesperson for the Human Rights Campaign, said the spot will run 20 times on television stations in San Diego during the Republican convention there next week. He said the group also is considering pushing the issue in key races nationally. A second spot features a political consultant who argues that a recently passed law banning federal recognition of same-sex marriages is a political plum. This is the issue Americans can understand, he said. Nobody cares about term limits or jobs. The controversial issue of outing is back in the news. On Friday, Congressmember Jim Colby, sixth-term Republican from Arizona, acknowledged he's gay. Colby came out of the closet because The Advocate, a national lesbian and gay magazine, was about to out him after Colby voted for the Defense of Marriage Act, a bill which would federally define legal marriage as between a man and a woman only. The only Republican to vote against the law was the openly gay congressman from Wisconsin, Steve Gunderson. We're now joined by two people to talk about the issue of outing, the politics, the ethics, and the history of outing. We're joined by Larry Gross, who is author of Contested Closets, The Politics and Ethics of Outing. Gross is a gay activist from Philadelphia and a professor at the Annenberg School of Communications at the University of Pennsylvania. We're also joined by David Greer of the Log Cabin Republicans. And David, why don't we begin with you, your reaction to Jim Colby coming out and the circumstances under which he did last Friday.
Well, first off, we applaud Congressman Colby for having the courage to step forward and discuss publicly his sexual orientation. Nothing helps to break down the stereotypes on Capitol Hill than to have somebody announce that he is gay, who is also a high-ranking member on both the Appropriations and the Budget Committee, who's more known for his NAFTA votes and things along those lines. So we certainly applaud him for taking this stand and moving forward and announcing his sexual orientation. The manner to which that he was outed, we have a couple of questions with. I think that there is a forcible outing a situation here, and not one that is completely justified. And so the fact that Congressman Colby did take the bulls by the horn and step out on his own, that's what we really want all people to do. But we understand that this is a very personal and private issue and one that people have to move along at their own rate.
What do you say to those who say that they feel that people should be outed who are hypocritical? He voted against the same-sex marriage. He voted for the Defense of Marriage Act, which would ban same-sex marriage.
Well, you know, Congressman Colby has an outstanding record on gay and AIDS issues. This man is a co-sponsor of the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, which bans discrimination in the workplace on the basis of sexual orientation. He's also a co-sponsor of the Workplace Fairness Act, another employment discrimination bill, which would protect gays and lesbians. He co-sponsored Ryan White. He employs a non-discrimination pledge in his office. I mean, every other vote, he has been there for this community and continues to be. So to base just one vote and suddenly say that he is a hypocrite, I think is a little tenuous argument at best when he's there every single time for us.
Professor Larry Gross, your view on Jim Colby's outing.
Well, I have a very different view than Mr. Greer. First of all, just to quickly correct something that he said, the HRC, the Human Rights Campaign, issues a congressional scorecard, and in the 102nd Congress, they gave Colby a 50% rating, and in the 103rd Congress, they gave him a 60% rating. So whereas compared to many of his Republican colleagues, he has had a good record on gay issues, the HRC has not given him 100%
rating. Well, HRC also ranks on other things than gay issues.
I understand. Well, let me speak. You spoke.
So, and we recently ranked Congressman Colby in the 104th Congress, and he came out ranked sixth, a leader in gay and lesbian issues.
The concern I have here, however, is if you look at the Defense of Marriage Act, which was the most explicitly and viciously anti-gay piece of legislation yet introduced in Congress, one Republican voted against it, and that was Steve Gunderson, who, I should remind us all, was outed. Steve Gunderson didn't step out of the closet. Steve Gunderson was the target of outing for a long time before he became openly gay. And as he has become openly gay, he has found finally the courage to stand up and speak out against the anti-gay efforts of his colleagues in Congress. He has become courageous. I hope that this will now happen with Congressman Colby. Congressman Colby says that I am a gay person has never affected the way that I legislate. Well, that's very unfortunate, and I don't think that African-American members of Congress or women members of Congress would want to say quite the same thing about their identity. I think that people in Congress have to be at least able to stand up and speak out for things that affect them and millions of other Americans. The debate about DOMA was a vicious
defense
debate in which Congressman Barr was saying things about the flames of hedonism are licking at the very foundations of our society, the family unit. I've checked the congressional record. Congressman Colby didn't say a word during that debate. He sat silently there while gay people were attacked in the most vicious language. They were defended by John Lewis, African-American from Georgia, Democrat, but they were not defended by Jim Colby. I think the shameful aspect of this situation, and it's not his choice, but it's one that he has to face in reality, is that gay people are being used as a target of opportunity. And I hasten to add that Bill Clinton is every bit as guilty. He has announced his support for DOMA and that he will sign it. And I think that every gay person should take him to task for that.
Where does this stop then? Where does the outing stop? President Clinton supports DOMA. Should every person in the Clinton administration now be outed because ultimately the president supports DOMA?
Well, I don't know about every person. I think some of the gay people. I think that the
every positive person of the Clinton administration, should they be outed? No, I'm just asking a question.
I think the gay community accepts a double standard that other groups would not accept. It is very much like Jews in Germany in the 20s when there was anti-Semitism throughout the country, who thought that they were so assimilated that nobody would really attack them ultimately, and that they could ignore, you know, anti-Semitism as a peripheral issue. Well, it turned out not to be. We are now the targets of opportunity of politicians. And hiding in the closet and saying it's a completely personal matter is one thing at times when you're not being attacked, but that is the matter, that is the grounds on which people are being attacked. This is a form of hypocrisy. Now, a few years ago, when there were outing debates all over the country, after Malcolm Forbes and other famous outings, which is the stuff I wrote the book about that you referred to, that Amy referred to earlier, the consensus among those in the media and elsewhere who were not pro-outing was that the cases that were least problematic, the cases that were sort of not even very ambiguous, were prominent people like public officials, like elected officials, who were secretly gay and voted or supported anti-gay policies. And voting for DOMA is exactly such an act.
We're listening to Larry Gross, who is author of Contested Closets, The Politics and Ethics of Outing, and he's a professor at the Annenberg School of Communications at the University of Pennsylvania. And we're joined by David Greer, who's with Log Cabin Republicans, which is the gay and lesbian Republican group. David Greer, your response again to that point of gay and lesbian in the closet people who are basically hurting their own, you know, hurting people in their community.
Well, once again, I think to draw the analogies between now and Nazi Germany is an exaggeration, especially with the Defense of Marriage Act.
Really? The 1934 Nuremberg laws forbade
intermarriage. I'm not going to argue that what is behind the Defense of Marriage Act may be animus. That I can absolutely see, because what they're trying to get at is really to divide President Clinton from gay Democrats who support him. That's what really the Defense of Marriage Act is all about. But again, when you start looking at reasons to out people, and if those reasons happen to be votes in Congress on specific legislation that is perceived to be against the community, we have to go back and question what is the best thing for gay people. And that is because oftentimes, if your view and role of government is different from that of other people's, then how can you decide what's best for the gay community? A good example. If you happen to be someone who believes in the right to freedom of association, you would not be for the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, because if you happen to be running a gay magazine and you only want to employ gay people, when you then pass an Employment Non-Discrimination Act, and that says you can't discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation, your right to discriminate and only hire gay people is taken away. Are you not hurting a gay person and their rights to freedom of association? So therefore, I'm saying all of these votes cannot always be perceived as anti-gay, depending on your view and role of government.
Well, they're to begin with.
So that's why I have an enormous issue with outing to begin with in the first place, because who is to say what is the best thing for the gay community?
Well, look, there are so many issues that you raised. Now, if you're suggesting, as you apparently are, that the Log Cabin Club would not have supported the Civil Rights Act of 1964,
I'm not saying that
employers should be able to discriminate on the basis of race or gender, well, why is that any different than saying that they should be able to discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation? The implication of the Log Cabin Republican Club is that discrimination by employers should not be prohibited by government. That's a pretty radical statement. On the other hand, if the view is that discrimination should be permitted on the grounds of sexual orientation only, then I think the Log Cabin Republican Club, as a gay organization, needs to seriously examine whether it's more loyal to the Republican Party than it is to the gay community.
Well, we do have a different
DOMA
mission.
Is not an ambiguous piece of legislation. DOMA is directly an attack on gay people. It has been described by constitutional
experts. This is a community that didn't even decide. Remember, the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force putting out all this stuff about the oppressive nature of marriage, the oppressive patriarchal nature of marriage. Only suddenly, because we got the right, the ability to win marriage, have we suddenly been getting behind marriage. Remember, marriage has not been the focal point of the gay community movement.
Well,
it has not been our issue.
The only reason we're
jumping on it and suddenly changing is because the right is suddenly there.
Yeah, have that argument with a representative of NGLTF, because I'm not one. In fact, the marriage issue has been on the table since 1970. In 1970, the Los Angeles...
But it has not been agreed upon by the gay community as our issue.
The gay community does not have a central committee.
The community has been divided as to whether or not we should even pursue marriage, because marriage is a patriarchal, oppressive institution which oppresses people. And we are already oppressed enough in our gender identification as gay people to begin with.
Well, I'm very interested to know that the Log Cabin Club is now opposed to patriarchy, which is a good move forward. However, the issue...
I didn't say that.
The issue has been on the table since 1970. Certain organizations, I'm not a representative of an organization, the fact that organizations may not favor it, right, it comes up from the grassroots. It continually comes up because gay couples and lesbian couples who do not understand why they should be excluded from the basic right of civil marriage. I'm not talking about religious marriage. That's between them and their faith. But civil marriage, why they should be put in second-class status, denied benefits, denied access to all kinds of benefits, including health insurance and tax benefits, immigration and other things, why they should be put in that second-class status, they don't understand it. Now, there are many national organizations that are more concerned about their access to politicians and to political insiders than they are about hearing what it is that their communities want. I am not defending them.
Mm-hmm.
And in any case, the issue we started with here, you know, the other issues I'm perfectly willing to discuss at length, but the issue we started here was outing. And the question comes down very simply to the question of whether or not this community is ever going to make serious progress if even its highly placed members, like members of Congress, are unwilling to be open about who they are. It is Jim Colby's who perpetuate the notion that being gay is a dirty secret that you can't talk about. He didn't even tell his family until all of this happened. Right? His brother wrote an article supporting him, but pointing out that up until last weekend, he hadn't even told his family.
Hmm.
Now, his brother also said, though angry at being forced to make this revelation, he is quietly relieved that he will now be spared the arduous daily grind of keeping his personal genie in a bottle. And if you look at what Gary Studd said after he was outed by a scandal back in the 80s, he said, you know, I now feel better than I've ever felt. He said, I feel as if the remaining seven cylinders had just kicked in for the first time in 46 years. In fact, these people are to a large extent victims, and they're victims in Colby's case, of a party and of a society which tries to keep them in the closet.
Larry Gross, you talk about other politicians who have been outed by AIDS activists as well as gay and lesbian activists.
Right.
Can you talk about the history of this and who has been outed?
Well, outing really didn't begin until AIDS. There had been certainly a lot of talk. And in the early years of the Reagan administration, when there were a fair number of highly placed closeted gays, there was a lot of talk in Washington about why should we keep their secrets while they're supporting anti-gay moves or causes. Terry Dolan was one case who began sort of the right-wing PAC movement and later died of AIDS. But it was the AIDS epidemic and the massive sort of unwillingness of the government to respond to the crisis that I think finally pushed things over the edge. And it was militant AIDS activists like ACT UP that began it. They began it with Senator Mark Hatfield out in Oregon. They put up a poster with Governor Jim Thompson in Illinois. Those were the first instances of outing, really. The one that caught the public and the media attention was Malcolm Forbes, who was outed by Mike Signorelli after he died. I mean, it wasn't even, during his lifetime. But that's because Forbes was such a visible figure, and because of the, you know, much trumpeted phony business about him and Elizabeth Taylor having a romance, that it became a major media issue. And the other component besides AIDS that fed into the sort of issue of outing was the immense, unrelenting appetite of the media and apparently the public for gossip about public people's, public figures' private lives. You know, outing came around at the same time that the New York Times was putting on its front page the allegations in a book about Nancy Reagan that she and Frank Sinatra, you know, were having quickies upstairs in the White House while Reagan was president. You know, that kind of completely, as far as I know, unsubstantiated allegation about the First Lady having an affair in the White House was on the front page of the New York Times. Yet the fact that, you know, that some public figure was gay, you know, and doing nothing, outrageous or scandalous, would be treated by the media as too private to ever talk about.
Larry Gross, on that note, we're going to have to wrap up. Larry Gross, author of Contested Closets, The Politics and Ethics of Outing, and David Greer of the Log Cabin Republicans, who they will be holding their national convention this week in San Diego. Thanks very much for joining us. Up next, we'll hear from some gay politicians and political aides. That's on Democracy Now! Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. One way a politician can avoid being outed is to be truthful about their sexuality in the first place. Rick Zabor is hoping to become the first openly gay person to the U.S. Congress from California. Anthony Fess reports on Zabor's effort to unseat moderate Republican Steve Horn.
They can't.
All right, we'll do that.
Well, it's nice meeting you.
Thank you.
Take care. We'll see you.
It's a peaceful Sunday morning in Signal Hill, a small community near Long Beach, California. Classic car fans are gathering in a city park for an exhibition of hot rods and restored antique cars. Congressional candidate Rick Zabor walks between the Porsches and Packards, looking for hands to shake.
How are you?
Good.
Do you live here in Long Beach?
Sure do.
Oh, you do? Well, you can vote for me. It's
sure.
Information about my campaign.
Okay.
You Republican or Democrat?
Republican.
Republican. Well, I've got lots of Republican supporters, so.
Hey, I'll read everything and make my decision.
Well, that's great. What's your name?
Jim.
Jim, what part of Long Beach do you live in?
East Long Beach.
Uh-huh. What do you do other than collect cars?
Other than have cars and collect them? Uh-huh. I'm in the packaging business.
No, really? Yeah. That's terrific.
The 39-year-old environmental lawyer wears a purple polo shirt, checkered sport coat, and gray slacks. He makes a point of telling people he's a newcomer to electoral politics. This race for the House of Representatives is his first campaign for public office, and Zabor says it was the extremism of the current Republican Congress that prompted him to run.
The Republicans, I think, have an agenda that is really hostile to the interests of working families in this country. You know, they are cutting programs that give opportunities for kids, student loan programs, gang prevention programs in the school, Head Start, that provide retirement security for our seniors, Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security, and that keep our environment and our workplaces safe and clean. And they're basically cutting all of these programs in order to provide a tax cut for people at the upper income levels.
Zabor's campaign literature explains how he worked his way from a New Mexico farm town to Harvard Law School. He now lives in Long Beach and works for a Los Angeles law firm, where he handles air quality compliance issues. Democrats outnumber Republicans by a 15% margin in the 38th district, but many of those Democrats are conservatives who readily cross party lines. The incumbent congressman is Republican Steve Horn, a former university president. Horn is a relatively moderate Republican, at least on social issues. He's pro-choice, he voted in favor of the Brady handgun control bill, and he supports legislation to outlaw employment discrimination based on sexual orientation. Sherry Bebich Jeffy is a senior associate at the Center for Politics and Economics at Claremont Graduate School and a longtime observer of politics in Southern California. She says Horn is no extremist.
And it will, in the end, be somewhat difficult for Zabur to paint Steve Horn as Newt Gingrich. Steve Horn has now represented that district long enough for people to have an understanding of who he is and what he stands for.
But challenger Zabur insists there are major differences between his positions and those of Horn. Zabur says he would have voted against the cuts in Medicare, Medicaid, and student loans, which Horn supported. And what of Zabur's personal life? The candidate doesn't think his sexual orientation will make much difference in November's election.
I think that the fact that whether a person is gay or lesbian is irrelevant, and I think, you know, the substantial majority of people in this district agree with that. You know, there will always be some small percentage of people who will take that into account in an adverse way, but you know, those folks tend to be people that are not going to vote for someone who's pro-choice and someone who's a Democrat anyway, so we don't think it's really going to have much of an impact in this race.
People at the Signal Hill car show say a candidate's being gay won't necessarily affect their votes.
No, not as long as he had the same views as me.
Not unless they make a big thing out of it.
It doesn't make any difference to me. I mean, I don't care if he's a good man and has the views that I have.
Does it matter to me where a candidate is gay or straight? Never been asked that question before. It would depend on the circumstances and what office he's running for.
Long Beach has a substantial gay and lesbian community. The city's annual Gay Pride Parade is the fourth largest such celebration in the country. But Zabur may not be able to count on universal support, even among gays and lesbians, because Steve Horn has been friendly to the gay community. Jack Newby, president of the Long Beach Gay and Lesbian Community Services Center, says Horn has been a reliable supporter of local gay, lesbian, and AIDS organizations. He also credits Horn for denouncing the recent homophobic remarks of a city council member, even though the local Republican Party endorsed the anti-gay comments. Newby says he's still undecided.
I'm in a quandary over the election with Steve Horn and Rick Zabur. On one hand, Steve Horn is a moderate Republican that's been certainly open to talking with the gay and lesbian community and has been supportive and has a proven track record. And we have Rick Zabur, who's an openly gay candidate. And my quandary is having the importance of having a difference between having a friend in an elected position or having someone who is gay and lesbian who truly understands our position.
Political observers say Zabur will face an uphill battle trying to unseat Steve Horn. The local economy is on the upswing, and Horn hasn't given the district many reasons to vote against him. But win or lose, if Zabur's sexual orientation never becomes a campaign issue, that would represent a victory for the gay community.
How are you?
For Pacifica Network News, this is Anthony Fest in Long Beach, California.
Nice to meet you. Uh-huh. Where do you live?
Thanks, Anthony. In the 1990s, gay issues have become a political football in presidential and congressional elections. Bill Clinton was the first presidential candidate to seriously court the gay and lesbian vote by promising to lift the ban on gays and lesbians in the military. But that pledge crumbled in Clinton's first 100 days, and gay activists say Clinton's don't ask, don't tell compromise has actually produced more witch hunts, harassment, and dismissals of gay and lesbians in the armed services. This time around, President Clinton is playing both sides of the fence. He denounces discrimination against gays, but promises to sign a measure that would ban gay marriages on the federal level. David Mixner is a longtime Clinton friend and advisor who helped him win the White House in 1992. Mixner has written a memoir called Stranger Among Friends about his relationship with the Clintons and the Democratic Party. He spoke with Pacifica's Don Rush.
Well, you know, I've known the president for over 25 years. We first met at a reunion of McCarthy Kennedy workers in 1969 at Martha's Vineyard. One of the things I've come to realize over the years is that Bill Clinton has become an expert at befriending those who are making change while avoiding making change himself. The Marion Wright Edelmans, the people in the anti-war movement, the people in the civil rights movement like John Lewis or myself in the gay and lesbian movement, he made a real effort to befriend all of them by way of avoiding those movements altogether while he was growing up and developing politically. I came to trust him on the gay and lesbian issue because he treated myself and my partner extremely well. When I came out of the closet in 1976, which just wasn't done in politics at that time, there was no Time magazine covers, movies of the week. Both Mrs. Clinton and him were tremendously supportive, where others weren't. When my partner contacted AIDS and finally died in 1989, again, both of them were extraordinarily personally there for me and for my partner. So I saw firsthand on a personal level that, one, he knew gay and lesbian people, which was remarkable. Two, that he I felt he understood our struggle because of our personal journeys. And the fact that he unconditionally was there for us as openly gay men at that time. And yes, I think I was seduced a little bit. I mean, you know, he has that remarkable quality of the hug, whispering intimacies in the ear. He is a great toucher, you know. I mean, a man or woman, he takes your arm and walks down the street and listens intently and makes you feel like the most important person in the world.
Do you think that there's something genuine behind this, or do you think there's, or do you think this is all facade?
Oh, I think the man's good at heart. In fact, I think both of them are very much good at heart. I think there's a genuineness to it. I think that what the president has to understand is that his escape from hope is over. You know, we both grew up in small-town America, and the way you escape from those towns, especially impoverished small rural towns like we both came from, is to befriend those in authority, to be, please them, to get the one or two scholarships that will enable you to leave and to go into a broader world. So you develop skills to do just that, to please people in authority, to receive validation from them so that you can get out and so you can be successful. And I think he's made a career out of people-pleasing politics. But what he doesn't understand that he's achieved his greatest dream now. And it's time for him to start putting aside, putting his finger to the wind to see if people will still like him and start acting presidential to rise to a greater good when it's required on a presidential level.
Do you think in some ways that the mask that he presents, that is to get along, to rise up, do you think that that's become so inextricably part of him that it would be very difficult to jettison that part of him now?
I think it would be very difficult to jettison that part of him, and that's where I think it falls upon the shoulders of the progressive movement. I think we have been lazy in organizing. I think we have, and I include myself in that, I think we have been lazy in bringing ourselves together in a broad coalition and demanding some sort of excellence from him. I think that's the only thing that's going to break in through that barrier that he has between us and good politics. I mean, I think whether it's the gay or lesbian marriage issue or putting a million children into poverty on this new welfare bill, both are unconscionable. And it's important that all of us speak out on all of it. And we've got to get our act together. You know, the Christian Coalition's been organizing. They've been taking over school boards. They've been taking over water boards. They've been taking over taxation boards at the local level. And for years, I think, on the progressive movement and on the left, we have accepted the criteria that they're better than the other guy. And so we have always been put in that position of accepting someone just a little better than someone worse. And I think we shouldn't accept that anymore.
Now, you have a chapter heading which is entitled Betrayals. Focuses on gays in the military, although it could be very well applied this year with the gay marriage. Tell me about your experience, particularly in terms of gays in the military, and what seems to, at least you describe, as a sort of disillusionment with the White House.
No, it isn't sort of. I was disillusioned with the White House, very much so. You know, Bill Clinton has done more for than any other president in history for the gay and lesbian community. It's important for me to say that because It would be untruthful if I didn't. But the fact of the matter is, it would be like saying to African Americans in 1963, I've just given you a civil rights bill. I've done more for you than any other president in history, so don't ask me for the right to vote. You know, there's no such thing as partial freedom, nor is there anything that the president of the United States dispensing rights when it's politically convenient and politically comfortable. Bill Clinton in 1992 said to us, there is no battle too great or too vicious that I will not stand by your side. You can count on me to be there, to be your champion, and to defend your freedom no matter what the cost. And at one point in the same speech, he put his hand out and said, help me God, I would give up my presidency if I could cure you all of AIDS. You know, and we believed it. Perhaps our expectations were too high, but we had desperately waited for years to hear those words from someone running for the president of the United States. When he got into office, what we didn't realize is that, yes, indeed, when it was politically comfortable for us that he would be there, and he did make appointments. He's come out against these anti-gay initiatives. He sent Justice Department officials to Mississippi when two lesbians were harassed in their farm, so he's done stuff like that. But the fact of the matter is they've never fully accepted this as a civil rights movement. To them, it's another political interest group to deal with when it was politically convenient. And those of us who have been the victims of gay bashing or seen firebombings of leadership's homes or MCC churches burned down, or as in my case, 256 friends die of AIDS, and my partner of 12 years die of AIDS, know indeed that our journey is one about civil rights and equality. And so we have to somehow find a way to burst through to him, to make him understand that this is indeed a civil rights movement, not something that he can politically use when it's convenient.
One of the things that's always struck me about him is that when he's confronted with an awkward situation, and for instance, I've seen situations where he's been confronted with folks from the AIDS activists, and he says, he doesn't get angry, he says, look, he says, I understand, and I don't want this person to stop being angry and stop shouting. Which is what you seem to be saying, in effect.
Yeah.
Is that genuine?
Sometimes it's genuine, and sometimes we get one of his famous purple rages. I mean, after I got arrested outside the White House after the don't ask, don't tell policy, and it was sort of strange. I mean, I was outside getting handcuffs put in, and all my friends who were in the new administration's looking out through the windows. I mean, talk about surreal. I was banished from the White House for 5 months for that act of conscience. And I'm not quite sure what my status is these days because of speaking out on gay and lesbian marriages. One of the things they say, though, and I want to be real clear on this, you've got to give us some slack. We've done more for you than anyone has ever done before. That's like saying to African Americans, we've just given you the Civil Rights Bill. Don't ask us for the Voting Rights Bill. And even more important, I don't know who to go out and say that they should be gay bashed and beaten up because the president's not comfortable. I don't know who I should say that person should die of AIDS or because it's not a politically convenient time to really push this issue. And I don't know who to say that they should be fired from their job or to tell the mother that their son's going to kill themselves because they're ashamed of being gay and lesbian. My experience in politics is the moment you give a politician some slack is the instant that they'll want more.
Finally, I wanted to ask you about the upcoming Democratic Convention, because the platform seems to, and they seem to have backed away somewhat. And there's no, my understanding, there's no mention of gays in the military. There's sort of a generalized support for non-discrimination employment, particularly for gays and lesbians. Two things. One, is that a disappointment to you? And two, is there going to be some kind of platform fight or some kind of fight that you guys plan at the Democratic Convention?
Someone asked me where they could get a copy of the Democratic platform, and I said, look under the generic brands in the supermarket. It is so bland and so generic and has no substance, no passion, no vision in it. It is the safest, blandest thing I've ever seen in my life, quite honestly. On gay and lesbian issues, it doesn't mention gays and lesbians in the military, but it also doesn't deal with poor people. I mean, it's irrelevant, totally irrelevant. In fact, it's so irrelevant. And the convention is being so tightly run that I don't even plan to go to the convention this year for the first time since 1964. There's no reason to. There's not going to be any floor fights because no floor fights have a chance. There will be no serious discussion of the issues. It will be one big party, and I'm delighted, that we're going to come out strong for the November elections, but I can't see wasting the time there.
Former Clinton aide David Mixner, his memoir is called Stranger Among Friends. He was speaking with Pacifica reporter Don Rush. Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin with assistance from Pat Greenfield at the studios of Pacifica Station WPFW in Washington, D.C. John O'Leary has been our engineer. If you'd like to reach us, you can call our listener comment line at 202-588-0988, extension 313. That's 202-588-0988, extension 313. For a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. We love to get email. You can write to us at democracy@pacifica.org. That's democracy@pacifica.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!